Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Pieces from Prison, Episode 9. Today, we have a special guest. We are here with Michael Lacey. He was incarcerated here in Indiana for how many years? 21 years. And so this is going to be a really interesting episode. So we will ask him some questions, and we will start now. So Michael, where were you incarcerated at? What year were you incarcerated, and for how long?
Okay, so I got locked up in 1997. I was in the county jail for 2.5 years, and then I eventually got convicted. Then my first prison was Indiana State Prison, which I got sentenced to 60 years. So I went there, and I was there for like 10 years, and then I transferred to Miami Correctional Facility, which is in like near the Peru, Kokomo area in Indiana. I was there for 7 years, and then I transferred to the low-level facility in Plainfield and came home from there.
So you were sentenced to 60 years. How were you able to just do 21?
You know, that's actually a question I get asked a whole lot. And I think a lot of people don't know how sentencing works. So when I got convicted, which the law has changed since then. So when I get convicted in 99, you did 50% of your time. So I got 60 years, so I had to do 30 of it in prison. So I end up getting there. And then you can get 4 years worth of time, because I got some college degrees that knocked time off my sentence. And then I eventually went in like 2006 for a sentence modification. Basically, it was just like, okay, I've been doing all this good stuff in prison. Would y'all reduce my sentence? And they reduced my sentence to 50. So that's 50 to 25. I got the 4 years worth of time cuts, and that put me at 21 years and came home.
And so you said that's not something that happens often anymore, or is that like does that still happen? Yes.
Because the law changed. It was like now no longer in Indiana do you do 50% of your time. It's like if you got a nonviolent case, you have to do 75% of it, and if you got a violent case, you do 85% of it. And it's like, so the laws changed, but that used to be like the standard law. But one of the things is kind of, because like when I say that, like I had a 60-year sentence and then I say I did 21 years, a lot of people like, how does that work? And it just gave me this kind of insight that a lot of people wasn't into how sentencing actually works.
Yeah, I did not know that. I didn't know that you could do like, or get college degrees and it takes off time off your sentence.
Yep. It actually, because this is how, okay, so I got a degree in history and anthropology. So that knocked off 2 years off my sentence. And then they have like, let's say if you get different vocational programs, you can get a 6-month time cut here, 6-month time cut, you know, for if people get their GED, which I already had that when I went to prison. So it's like different things that you can do inside to get your sentence reduced. But when they changed the law, now you can only get up to 2 years worth of time cuts once you've been sentenced. That's when they changed the whole law. That was one of the things that also changed.
Interesting.
Okay, so this is great. I mean, hearing it firsthand about like things that have been changing, you know, with the law, and it's just so interesting. I think this is a great episode to actually hear firsthand like how this stuff works.
Me too. I didn't know all of that. That's really interesting. So do you just want to tell us about your story and a little bit about who you are?
Okay, we will start there. So come from Indianapolis, from the west side of Indianapolis, the Hallville area. And it's kind of, and I know this is kind of, it's cliche, but it's kind of the typical hood story. You know, you kind of grow up, you're around a certain element, drugs, gangs, all that stuff. You kind of get swallowed up in it. So that's kind of like the core of what led to the path of me ending up in prison. It's kind of, you know, just growing up in the hood. And, you know, so I that end up, basically, let me backtrack a little bit. So when I was growing up, I was always brainy. I always grew up reading comic books, stuff like that, because this plays into later. That's why I want to say this now. So I've always was like a brainy kid, like kind of smart, but I was like the kid that was like, you know, you're squandering your potential. And then got wrapped up in the whole, you know, the hood element. Started off kind of like the slippery slope. You start off stealing cars, and then next thing you know, you doing this and doing that. Next thing you know, you kind of like selling drugs and involved in a more aggressive aspect of the street life. But it's real important because later on, when we get to the later part of the story, the kind of the books, because that's one of the key elements which helped me excel in prison, was my kind of, I came through the door reader, and it had a major impact on how my prison experience went and what happened when I came home.
So were you, what was your like childhood? Like, were you close with your parents? Did you have a good relationship with your parents, and how were your friends?
Okay, so single parent, moms. I knew my father. He wasn't like just completely absentee, but I'm primarily raised by a single mother. I have a brother, older brother, 5 years. You know, there's a story to that too, which I'll tell it a little later. And we were real, real close. I have a very, very close-knit family because my mother is seven girls. Six of them moved from Mississippi up to Indianapolis together. So, you know, they have that real, like, close southern ties type of bond. So that's kind of what my kind of family structure looks like. It was a pretty, you know, people that work, not a lot of people getting caught up, like, in the streets. I was kind of one of the anomalies in my family in regards to the path I went down when it came to that. And my brother was very, very kind, very creative. I don't know if you want me to get into this now, but my brother actually got killed. I'll talk about it now because, so I get convicted in October of 1999. I get to prison in November, and it was my first visit. I'm 21 years old. I just got 60 years in prison. And my first visit, my mother comes to see me. You know, we kind of talk in the visiting room. And while we were in the visiting room, my brother was getting killed in Indianapolis. And it's like my mother, she only has two kids. My mother left the visiting room seeing her baby that just got all this time, and she had to go from the visiting room to identify the body of her oldest son. That was December 11th, 1999.
Well, I'm so sorry to hear that. That must have been really difficult, you hearing that news, and then you have your sentence. How was it for you to adjust to being incarcerated?
This is really, really important because, you know, everybody has a different prison experience. Depending on the mentality that you have when you walk through the door. Like for me, I had an artistic outlet. So like my first 4 or 5 years after I got all that time, and I'm just like trying to kind of wrap my head around this whole prison thing, is I was writing poetry. I probably wrote, in that time span, I probably wrote maybe 400 to 500 poems. And that's how I was expressing myself. And at the time, it was just like I was doing it. But then when I got a little older and more in tune to what was going on, it was my therapeutic way of working that whole situation out. I mean, as soon as I heard that news about my brother, I went and wrote a poem about my brother. You know, whatever I was kind of going through on a mental level, I was writing a poem about it. Some of them is kind of deep, darker stuff. Some of it can just be like kind of splashing in the shallow waters, what's going on in prison. And I just write a poem. So that's what got me through the early stages of kind of mentally conditioning or mentally equipping myself to deal with this situation I found myself in.
Do you feel like you already said that without poetry, you would have had like a way more difficult time, more, I feel like you would have been like more angry and like starting out in prison, and would have affected the, like your behavior in prison. I know they care about that a lot.
And I think that that's one of the reasons that some people have very difficult prison experiences is because they don't have something to, an outlet. Like, if you're not a person, like, it's two things. Anybody that done time with me, I'm identified with two things. It's like the cat that reads all the time and he writes all the time. Eventually, the writing turned into writing movies, screenplays and stuff. But it all started with poetry. But, like, I used to look around and I would, like, look around at some guys. It's like they're not into reading. They don't do, you know, any type of writing. They're not into anything artistically that you can do in prison. And that same person is sitting there with, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70 years, and they have no means to express themselves. And I think that begins the trajectory of getting involved in a lot of stuff in prison that is not, is definitely not good for you and will keep you there longer.
So that kind of like leads into our next question. What are you, passionate about? Are you still passionate about like poetry?
Okay, so the poetry thing, and the poetry is real important to my kind of journey, but it was one of those things that I think it just served a therapeutic purpose. But what it did show me was I was a pretty good writer. I was like, I can express myself pretty good when it comes to words on paper. And then I began to write, like, I would develop these characters in my poems. So, like, you know, and the character would encompass, like, a certain quality. So when I wrote future poems, I wouldn't have to go all into, like, this whole thing about it. But, like, I would just throw this character in there. If you know anything about kind of my writing, then you would kind of know what I'm talking about. But that led into writing short stories. Then the short stories became a little bit longer, and I was always thinking pictures. So as I'm writing these short stories, I'm seeing it in my head. And then one day the light bulb went off and I was like, I want to learn how to write movies. And that started, like, you know, my big, big purpose when it came to what I wanted to do when I came home was, you know, make movies. That was like my thing. And that took me through maybe the next 10, 12 years of my sentence was me consumed with learning, you know, learning the fundamentals of script writing, learning how to direct films, the places that books could take me. And a large part of my time locked up was consumed with that.
I just have a question about that. Like, what is the, when you say you do poetry, you're interested in, you know, writing scripts and movies, what's like the genre? What is the message that you want to get out with that?
Okay, so here now, because see, one of the things is like, I never, outside of my poetry, I never really wrote stuff that was directly connected to like my life experience. Like, okay, I'm from the hood, but I've never wrote a hood film. To me, it's no creative stretch because I come from it. It wouldn't be like hard for me to write that. And I've never wrote anything dealing with prison. And actually, when it comes to a, you know, like, oh, I'm not this guy that's kind of writing films that like have this big general kind of message. It's more like, always like, if I had to kind of pin the genre, it's more like if you take Quentin Tarantino, Rob Zombie type of vibe, it's that. It's kind of like, you know, you have all these elements of, you know, you have a little humor, you have a, you know, you'll get some violence, you'll get some, you know, some, because I do kind of inject kind of some intellectual stimulation, but it's all packaged in like this kind of bizarre, absurd world. And so that's kind of, that's where I lean toward.
Sounds interesting.
And you're still pursuing that today?
Yeah, that's my, I look at it like this. Okay, so there's a book, and I know a lot of people read it, Art of War by Sun Tzu. And Robert Greene's book, The 33 Strategies of War, also has a chapter in it, and it's about the death ground. And basically it's this. If you want to get the most, and mind you, Sun Tzu wrote it speaking from the angle of a general. If you want to get the most out of your troops, you put them on a, you know, on a footing where there is no retreat. And one of the things, when I was locked up, I wasn't one of those people that was like, oh, you know, I need A, B, C, D, E, F as far as plans. I put all my, I'm like, this is what I'm on, period. It's like, so, you know, I have to be on that. I mean, not that I have to, but, and then also I feel like that's my purpose. That's where I'm at. That's where I can get the drive, the determination, the will, the discipline, all those things that are needed to kind of push you forward when it comes to success and whatever you're trying to do. So that's my thing.
Well, I feel like you'll be really successful in that. Because we did notice you have like a pretty large following on TikTok and your other social media platforms. So what was your journey like to TikTok, and how did you find you could reach people that way?
Okay, now that's a very interesting story because I didn't see that coming. Now, mind you, I'm like Comrade Sin Q. There's a whole story behind the name. That name is very thought out, very, very thought out. But so me being in a videography photography, one of the things that I used to do when I was locked up is I would do a year in review. At the end of every year, I had notebooks filled with like, okay, 1999, what was my top five songs that I heard this year? What were my top five books I read that year? And then I would also do a, what could I be doing more of the next year that I haven't been doing this past year? That started when I was locked up. So I was doing that when I came home, and 2000 turning into 2020 turning into 2021, I was like, okay, videography, photography, I need to start doing more social media. You have to like bolster up your social media. And I have been watching TikTok videos. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to start doing more stuff on social media. And because if you look at my first few TikTok videos, none of it is dealing with prison. And I did a video where I mentioned that I'd done 21 years in prison. Not even, it was kind of like the backdrop of what I was trying to convey. It was trying to be funny. And it kind of like, boom. And then I start getting all these questions about prison stuff. And then I start encountering other people that had like big accounts, and their whole thing, they was talking about prison stuff. And I'm like, oh, there is an audience for this. But one of the things that I kind of came at it a different approach is I didn't want to feed into what people see in movies. You know, so kind of, and I do, so I come at it from a more intellectual type of aspect and revealing some things about, you know, that life that certain people may not even think about. Like, I had done a video before, and I, like, what was the funnest time I had in prison? Now, people, and it wasn't a question that somebody asked me, but it's one of those things people don't really take in, like, do you have fun days in prison? Because sometimes it's like, I think people think, like, human nature. You, like, things that are innate within the human DNA, when you step into a prison, those things fall off. And it's like, nah, just like some days you wake up in life and you down and out, feeling kind of bad. Yeah, that goes on in prison. Sometimes you wake up and you like, hey, I'm going to turn up and have a ball. And you get that done in prison. And things like compassion, caring, concern, all those type of qualities exist in that environment. And I just think it's one of those things that sometimes people, they don't think about that. So I like to kind of highlight that type stuff.
That's good to hear, because I feel like that's what we try to kind of fight against, just the, you know, the typical stereotypical thing, you know, narrative that everyone has about someone who commits crimes or ends up in prison. So that's good to hear.
And it's very prevalent. I mean, because it's like, I'm going to tell you my most asked question. Now, mind you, it's like, because a lot of stuff that I didn't see, it started to evolve from my TikTok account. And we talking, I mean, I'm almost at like a million followers on there. And I don't think I talk about, you know, prison stuff, but like some of the questions that I get, like the most asked question, this is it hands down, the drop the soap thing. It's like, I get that, like, if I'm talking like, you drop the soap, you know, you know, some people make it funny, some people are asking in a serious type of way. And that's when, if anybody has been to prison, then you know, prison rape isn't a thing like that. It's just not. I mean, it, but you know, it's kind of like stuff like that though. People kind of feed into what movies, you know, kind of show what they kind of get from movies and stuff like that. And then they kind of think that that's really what that lifestyle is about. And it's, you know, it's not at all. Not, it's just not. So I just try to kind of keep it, you know, just trying to provide a more realistic window into what that, you know, life looks like. And then for me, it's like, I think I get a little more credibility because, you know, I guess like the prison that I started at, you had to have 45 years or more to like get in. They wasn't even like 45 years or more, you can't come in here. So it wasn't like, I wasn't at like a minimum security, you know, a prison. They had a death row there. I actually used to work on X row. That's what you call it when you actually there. So it's like the big house. And it's like, I was there for a long damn time. So it's, I know what that kind of life looks like. And a lot of what people think, it ain't that.
So that actually kind of answers our next question too. What would you like to accomplish with your videos? So you want more people to realize that there's a lot more than what they see in the movies and what they see in the documentaries.
Yeah, so, that's your most asked question. Wow. Like, we got a long way.
I know.
We have a lot of education to get out there.
I was not even thinking of that at all. That, I can't believe that.
I mean, but you would have like, and I think some of it, because one of the things I don't try to indict what people kind of think or what they know, because, you know, some people, they just like, they don't have no real experience with it. And then you even look at a lot of times people that talk about it, because see, I think some people, they like to bolster up their own kind of tough guy image. And so what they do is they portray like prison is this big bad place, and you know, since I was there, I have to be big and bad. And it's like, I don't feel like I have to justify myself in that fashion. So, you know, it's like, I just try to provide, like, it's human. If I have to say the premise of my whole kind of, when it comes to my social media videos about prison stuff, it is to showcase to people that prison is not something unhuman. It is it's circumstances, it's very unique circumstances, but the people that are put within those circumstances are human, and it's certain things that just are a part of who we are. And it's not like, you know, these people in prison was beamed in from Mars. And it's just like adding a human element to it, because a lot of people, and it's like, they see kind of how I am, and I'm known as the positive guy, like on the TikTok platform, it's like, I don't get a lot of like hate comments, none of that. I'm like known as like the positive guy. But then it's like, oh, one of the most positive people on this app is the same guy that did 21 years, 2 months and 11 days in prison. So it's just like trying to humanize and show like I'm not an anomaly. Like, I know there was a lot of guys that I was around every day that they can talk about all types of various academic, intellectual kind of concepts. They're people that are well-read, they're well-spoken. I'm not this kind of, you know, he's a special one. Nah, I know a lot of me in there. I just so happened made it home.
So my next question is gonna be, how was it adjusting to life after being incarcerated, especially for so long, 21 years, how did you find your way outside?
Okay, so, and I get that. People ask that a lot too. People, because, and it is like, I see why people ask it. But here, okay, so you think about it like this. Prison is just like, for instance, I was at one facility, there was 5,000 people there. Now, new people are coming to prison every day. So that means, yeah, I've been locked up 16, 17 years, but there's somebody in a unit that has just gotten locked up 6 months ago. So, and I'm saying that to say there is certain, like, there's this transferring of information in regards to, like, what's going on. You know, and then, you know, people are doing a lot of reading, and magazines are very valuable in that fashion because, see, sometimes magazines, in a prison setting, magazines just ain't for entertainment. Magazines can kind of keep you up on, like, the evolving of time, you know, what's how times are evolving. But for me, it was like, so I knew, like, technology had changed a lot. But those things are learnable. That's how, in my mind, it was like, okay, I may not know how to work an iPhone, but if somebody, if I'm confident enough that if somebody sit down with me with enough time, boom, I can learn it. So I wasn't really like anxiety ridden about coming on, about coming home. But what was, and I did a video about this, because see, this is sometimes stuff be right in your face. I did a video about this on TikTok. The video got like about three, four million views. And I asked, what was the most difficult adjustment about coming home? They even put this on BuzzFeed. Like, that video hit BuzzFeed because nobody thought about this. Okay, so I get locked up in 97. I come home 21 years later. Okay, I've been eating prison food for 21 years. So when I come home, everybody is taking me to these restaurants and they asking me, what do I want? I don't know what anything at McDonald's tastes like anymore. I don't know, like, I would go to these fancy restaurants and people asking me what I want. And I'm like, I don't know what none of this shit on the menu tastes like. And it's like one of those things. It's just like, and then after that video, all the comments is like, it makes sense. But people never have really thought about that. Because that was one I didn't see coming. But so when it comes to, you know, coming home, it was just like I came home knowing that there was some things that I have to find out. I'm coming home and I want to be a filmmaker. Now, mind you, books can only take me so far. I didn't know nothing about how to work cameras and stuff like that. So that's what I had to learn when I get home. But the greatest tool that I found when I made it home was YouTube. I actually think YouTube may be the greatest, depending on how you use it, it may be the greatest educational tool that humans have came up with in a long time. Because when I wanted to know something, it was like, I just YouTube it and watch videos about it. I said, because when I came home, I had to do a year house arrest. So I didn't get released from prison home. Had to do a year house arrest. And that's where I'm like learning how to work these cameras. I'm just watching YouTube videos all day. And so it wasn't a big adjustment. It was for me, but I just felt like there, I shouldn't know certain things. And I kind of walked out of there accepting, like, I know I shouldn't know how to do this and do that. I can learn how, though. And that kind of set the trajectory for me when I came home, that mindset.
So did you have, like, a good support system when you got out? Were your, like, how was your family?
Yeah. So because I lost a lot of friends locked up, like, a lot. So I came home pretty much, you know, like a blank slate. Like, I came home, my mother, who rolled out my whole time with me. And then, you know, I had my family. And then after that, it was kind of like, I had to find friends. But I did have a pretty strong family structure that, like, when I came home on house arrest, you know, I'm at mom's house, you know, I have, like, my cousins, my family was supportive in there for me. So it ain't like I was just kind of like, I had to figure it out by myself. I did have a pretty strong family support system, not really a friend base, because I didn't have any friends when I came home because I had done so much time.
That's important. So you mentioned like listening to some of our podcast episodes before. Do you feel like you can relate to anyone that we've done episodes before?
Okay. The first, and I actually think, because I know when that environment, when you are sitting, because I can imagine what it's like, because this is what I was thinking about when I was listening to y'all podcast before, you know, kind of like getting an idea of what's going on before I show up here. Is like, I know what the environment looks like when a person gets a piece of mail from somebody who they don't know, and then you open it and this is what it's about. Like, I know what that looks like. So being that I know what that looks like, I know the headspace that it puts a person in. And when you are put in a certain headspace, there is like universal things that anybody that done some time will probably be able to understand. Like, for instance, I think it was the first episode where the guy was saying how he felt like people had forgot about him. You know, because, I mean, one of the common things you hear all the time in prison, out of sight, out of mind. I mean, it's like a real thing. Hell, it's a real thing, not just in prison. You know, you have a friend that moved to another state, you know, and it's like, hey, you don't see him too much, you start thinking about him a little less. So that kind of, and that's in prison, that's put to the 10th degree. So, you know, when kind of like that, and then it was the guy, I found this story pretty interesting too, because he was kind of globetrotting. He went to the Middle East for a while, and then his father had a farm, and, you know, a kind of situation, had some land, a situation happened on the land. But when he was talking about kind of like that, kind of, you know, just how sometimes people just find themselves involved in like a gang lifestyle. Because a lot of times you from that, it ain't a choice. Don't many people wake up and be like, I'm going to join a gang today. It don't happen like that.
No, and that's like what a lot of them have said. It's like been a lot of their environment and the friends that they chose to hang out with. But a lot of the people in our episodes have said that they don't have like that great of a family life. Like the one that you were just talking about, how he, like his father had like a farm and he was in gang life too. His father was like also in like the drug trade and stuff too. Well, I'm not sure how your mother was, but it seems like she was, I don't know, would you say she was involved with like the friends you chose to hang around with?
Okay, so here's how this worked for me. And this is where I actually began to understand the importance of both parents. This is, and because I grow up, like my mother worked two jobs most of my childhood. You know, she's trying to provide, she's doing that. But the flip side of that is I didn't have a lot of parental advisory. So I was the kid that wakes up, my mother's gone to work when I wake up to go to school. And then when I come home from school, my mother's probably not going to be home this, you know, 7, 8, 9 o'clock, because she had another job she was going to. And that's to me, that's when I began to understand, like, you know, the why it's important for if you do have two parents in the household, because it's like, you know, your kids at those formative stages can have more advisory over them. But if you just got one and they trying to, you know, house and feed and do all that, they don't be having the time. And something else I understand about it is, and I to me, this is my reality, I also think that it's not a matter, I mean, what you learn in the house is important, because those values kind of, as you become an adult, you know, become more a part of who you are. But just as important is what you encounter outside the house. Because most of the dudes that I know I grew up with that turned out to be like in the streets, like hardcore, nobody, parents or whoever, was in the house telling them, go outside and do this, go sell drugs, go, you know, grab some guns, go do this and do that. Most people are not hearing that in the house. But when they leave outside, that shit is just as important as what's going on in the house.
I'm gonna like kind of backtrack a little bit to where you were, we were talking about how your experience like getting out. Do you feel like if you wouldn't have had like your mom or your family in your life, it would have been a lot different for you?
Totally. Because, see, I think, like, this is where, I think, like, what you get in the house and the type of family you're around, this is where I think it builds your character. But your character is not necessarily directly connected to the lifestyle you start to live. Because, see, when you come out of, like, if you got, like, a nice kind of family structure, you know, you get the values in regards to having respect, respecting your elders. You get, like, you know, when it comes to things like kindness and just being empathetic, those are things that you get in the house with the type of family you have. But you can still go out the house and become a gangster, though. But those qualities will also display themselves in that world. So I think a lot of, like, you know, how I kind of became, even when I was doing my prison experience, it was reflective of the values and principles that I was taught from my kind of family coming up. That's why I kind of always been a real, like, empathetic person. I've always been, like, very open-minded. I've always, like, valued education and things like that. So it, you know, it had a massive effect on all the stuff that happened to me afterwards. But those core things, you know, influence how I approach those things.
So I do want to talk a little bit about your crime and, I mean, just kind of what happened, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, we can talk about that. Now, okay, so, 'cause here's something. Okay, and I don't want to be long-winded. Sometimes I can get long-winded. I'm sorry about that. Okay, but I do want to kind of start this with this. Okay, in prison, when they change the rule book, okay, you get a rule book. You know, this is what you can't do. Now, anytime they change the rule book, they come around to each person and they have you sign a piece of paper and they give you the rule book. That way it's like, hey, we know you got the book. So if you get rolled up for something that we wasn't writing people up for last year, you got the book, so that's your fault. You can't be like, I didn't know that, we couldn't do that no more. So to get to how I end up in prison. Felony murder. And here's what fact, because a lot of people, I'm going to do a video about this probably tonight, probably this week, because there's not a lot of people who are aware of this. Okay, so felony murder is this, because I tell people I got 60 years for murder. If you pull up my packet, you know, online, you read it, plenty of people have. It's like, hey, on paper, I went to prison for murder. But I always try to tell people I never killed anybody. That creates issues finding jobs now. We can talk about that later. But felony murder is this. If you are engaged in a crime with somebody and the person that you're with dies, you are held responsible for their death. So, me and my friend get involved in a burglary. The homeowner killed my friend. And I was held responsible for my friend's death and given 60 years in prison for it. That's basically it in a nutshell. Now, I didn't find out, because the whole time it's like, I didn't find out that I was being charged with murder until I was in the, like, interrogation room type thing, and they told me. Because I'm in my mind, like, that has to be wrong. Like, I didn't kill him. Like, the homeowner killed him. Like, how y'all charged me with murder? And my attorney came to see me a few days later and was like, yep, that's law. That's like, there's a such thing as felony murder, and if you are involved in the commission of a felony with somebody and they lose their life, you are responsible for their death. And that's how I went to prison for all the time. Like, I never killed anybody, but I always have to, circumstances matter. So I always have to try to explain that, even when it comes to finding jobs and stuff when I came home, because if you just look on paper, it says murder, and it's like, hold on, let me kind of, these are the circumstances. I never killed anybody, like, with my own hands or something like that. So that's how I ended up in prison.
Well, that's something that's shocking to me. I mean, just how that is, how you can be charged with murder when you didn't actually, weren't involved in anything. Or were involved in the murder.
And there is a lot of people locked up like that. I found that out when I got there. Because it's like, there's like a lot of people that are sitting in prison with like 40s, 50s, and 60s that I'll give you an example. I had a buddy in prison. Him and his cousin got in a high-speed chase with the police. They crashed. His cousin, who was driving, died. And they charged him felony murder. They was in commission of a crime together. His cousin crashed. His cousin died. You're held responsible for his death. And they gave him 45 years in prison.
And his cousin was the driver? He was the passenger and his cousin was the driver?
His cousin was driving and he was the passenger. And he got 45 years for that. It's like a real thing. It's felony, felony murder. Like, yeah.
And can we touch? Sorry, go ahead.
Nah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I was just interested in something else that you touched on, which was how you had to explain that to future employers, because I feel like that would be something that's probably really, really difficult and something I have an issue with. Just, you know, it's a criminal justice reform kind of issue. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, it gets. Because, like, a lot of times, because when you start talking about, you know, like, when you start talking about, like, a murder case, that's kind of like, you know, that's the height of criminality. So when, you know, when I come home and it's like when people are pulling my background check, you know, employers aren't delving in to give me the motion of discovery or the probable cause. Only thing they're doing is, boom, they typing in, you know, your Social Security number. And this is coming up, not the circumstances for it. So when you pull up my information, it just says I was convicted of murder in 1999. And that right there is like a, you know, like a no-go in a lot of employer eyes. So that was one of the things, like, so early on when I came home and I would be filling out applications, and it was kind of, it's sad when you really think about it in regards to, like, you know, the bigger effects that it has on society in regards to, like, you know, giving people a second chance and stuff like that. But I had to, like, preempt all this before those conversations even came up. Like, when I fill out applications, I would, like, have to go and talk to the manager because I know they're getting ready to pull this up. And it's like, hey, I want to tell you, this is what you're going to see, but let me explain it to you. It wasn't like that. Like, here's a circumstance. Even to the point where I ended up getting a printout of my probable cause and all that, because if somebody can say it and it seems outlandish, like, I've done, like, TikTok videos and people, like, are mind blown, like, is that a real thing? And it's like, so I can say it to people and it's like, nah, I don't know about that. That don't sound right. So I end up getting, like, my probable cause and all that stuff, and I would, like, take it and show people, like, look, this is not me just, you know, saying some BS. This is, like, there's a law where this happens. And a lot of employers would be like, oh, I didn't know about that. Like, yeah, it's a thing. It's called felony murder.
And I think, Ariel, you can probably relate to this, too, since you are kind of in more direct communication with the people that we have on our podcast, the stories that we feature. I'm also do some volunteer work, and I've just noticed that people tend to have some, I don't know, they get into, you know, like an artistic thing. Like you said, a lot of people start writing poetry, they do stories, they have a lot of time for self-reflection. Is there anything, like any epiphanies or like something that you learned while you were in prison that kind of, that you like carry with you now, or something that you think about now that you're, you know, like, out?
I mean, I can go on and on with that, because, you know, it's just like the learning process is also going on while you're in prison. So your experience in life, it's different, but you also, you know, you're learning from your mistakes. And you're getting life lessons that you are applying into your future. Like, for instance, and I do a lot of TikTok videos about this, where I normally do like five of them, like five things I learned during my time in prison. And normally they're not like, they're kind of like real philosophical type of things. But just to give you like two right now, one of the things is, Nothing disturbs the trials of the present like the expectations of the future. And here, and I actually read that when I first encountered that in a book, it was just like, because it's like, and that's one of the ways that I made it through. It's like, nothing disturbs the trials of the present like the expectations of the future. If you really believe that you have a hopeful future, it makes whatever you're going through in the present a little less burdensome. If you really believe that about yourself, you know, and that concept took me through a lot of time in prison, just honestly believing like, hey, you know, things are going to work out. Because one of the things, it's like, I didn't have a life sentence, and mind you, I'm around people with a life sentence. I mean, I was working as a GED tutor on death row, and those guys had execution dates. So when I walked through the door, my 60 years wasn't that bad in regards to what I'm around. So that's kind of, you know, one thing that I always carry with me. Another one is, sometimes people got to build their wings on the way down. You know, sometimes it's like, when you headed down and you kind of, you know, in a bad situation, that's when the phoenix rise. So it's all depending on how you use the circumstances. So those are kind of just a few, but like I said, I can go, you know, on and on when it comes to just like things that, you know, influence my worldview and my philosophical approach to life that, you know, I got from there.
I actually have a question, and it's kind of going back. Sorry, this is like, I feel like all over the place, but were you close to the guy that you committed your crime with?
Yeah, very close. I mean, that's, and I never really delve into like the specifics of that. Probably the most I probably have really, really said about it. But it, cause see, that's an added element that like, even to my story that not even a lot of people is, I'm not just locked up. First of all, I'm 19, you know, I'm young. And I'm not just locked up and I get all this time, I'm locked up for a crime where I have to deal with kind of like the death of one of my friends. You know, so that's kind of a whole added layer of kind of mental strain. And then, you know, then my brother comes down the pike and get killed a little bit later. Then my two other best friends got killed too. Not to talk too much about death like that, but that's my reality though. So it was like we was real close. I mean, you know, I come out of a street element where you don't get involved in the type of stuff like we was involved in if you're not real cool with a person. And it's, you end up getting killed.
I feel like a lot of people in our letters talk about where they feel like they might have been if they weren't incarcerated. Do you feel like you would have been? What do you feel like your situation would have been if you hadn't done all this time in prison?
Okay, so I'm gonna answer that two ways. The first one is, the short answer is, if somebody said, if I wouldn't have went to prison, where would I probably be at now? And just to be really, really honest about it, I would probably be in a grave site somewhere. And the only reason I'm saying that is because, one, I accept responsibility for my mindset. And I don't try to portray, you know, something that I'm not. But I know when I got locked up, I wasn't one of these people that was in the streets thinking, oh, I'm just, you know, I'm trying to figure out some things and, you know, start trying to live a right life. It was like, nah, I was just like in the streets. That's what I was on. And with that being said, that was my mentality. And then I look at all the people around me who were my friends that during the course of, you know, those first 10, 12 years of when I was locked up, I mean, I had a lot of friends that died in the streets. I got a notebook I got a notebook and I would write down, because I was a notebook keeper in prison. I had notebooks for everything. And I would always write down when one of my friends got killed. And mind you, one of my things, in order for a person to go in the notebook, I had to like know him. It wasn't a person I kind of knew of. This is like a person like I hung out with, I knew. And there is a lot of names in that book, I mean, on those pages. So I think that that could have been me easy. But the flip side of it is this. Because I used to ask people this when I was in prison. People that I knew had made a genuine change. Like, how long did it take? And, you know, and for me, I would have to say that it took about 6 or 7 years. You know, I didn't need to do, damn it, 20 plus. But if I would have got out anything like 6 years before, there was a possibility I would have went back to the streets. But by like 7, 8 years in, I had completely turned the corner on that lifestyle. Like, it no longer was alluring to me. It was ugly. It was nasty looking. It was like y'all couldn't figure out nothing else to do. So that's kind of, you know, how that worked out.
That's something that we always say too, is like, there is clearly, like, you know, there's a point of, you know, consequences in prison, but there's also, there needs to be at some point, when do we say, like, someone gets a second chance? You know, you shouldn't be always paying for the mistakes that happened in the past. That shouldn't define you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, you are definitely right about that. And I, because, you know, and that's why I think one of the key components to prison reform, and why actually it's like, okay, so obviously you got the legislative reforms that need to take place. I mean, from when you start talking about the policing aspect, to when you start talking about the court system, to when you start talking about actually inside a prison and how there's a lot of things that need to change in there. But then also, coupled with hitting those three fronts, there also has to be a psychological reform of the public. Because it's like everybody knows this. Every human on the planet knows this. You go walk up to somebody that's 40 and you ask them, are you thinking the same way now as you was when you was 19? There's going to be a consensus. Hell no. But when it comes to people that happen to go to prison, that same thing, like, oh, you know, it's like, it doesn't apply. And I think that's why there has to be like a psychological reconditioning of how people think about, you know, people that happen to find themselves, you know, locked up and stuff, because it's like, you know, it could have been your damn neighbor. I mean, like, there's that saying that everybody, this is facts. Everybody, I'm just going to relegate it to the United States. Everybody in the United States is one decision away from being in prison. It's just one decision. That's it. Just one bad call, and your ass can be in there.
So what would you say to someone who was your age, 19, and they're going down the same road that you went down?
I think, and some of these are going to sound cliche, but just because something is cliche doesn't mean it doesn't have, you know, massive importance. It's having confidence. And what I mean by that is, like, you have to have confidence in order to be on what you want to be on. Because see, a lot of times people, they want to be accepted by, you know, whatever groups are around them or whatever people they're around, and they get swallowed up into these lifestyles, and in a lot of cases it wasn't really who they was. Sometimes people knew that early on. They just didn't have the confidence to be like, I don't care if y'all think I'm weird or whatever. I'm going to march to my own drummer. So that's actually one of the reasons that my prison experience turned out the way it was, because I came through the door. I was just like confident about what I was on. And trying to find who you are and what you're passionate about in life. And I know those are two statements, just like, you know, you'll see it on the principal's office on the damn sign or something, but it's like really genuinely trying to figure out who you are as a person. Because once you figure those things out, then you tap into what you really feel like you're here for in regards to like your passion. I think once people figure those things out, then kind of like your ship has left the shore. But it's like those two things, just trying to figure out who you really are, having confidence and accepting who you are, and don't care what people kind of think about you. Those are just two. And then understanding this, and this is just on like the street level of it. It's a, okay, Jay-Z. Jay-Z has in his book Decoded, he talks about like people in the streets and kind of like, he illustrates something I don't think a lot of people look at. He was like, whenever you're in the streets, you're gambling. And he was like, when you look at, because a lot of times people just looking at, okay, I'm hustling, I'm making money, but they don't look at the chips that they have on the table. When it's like, you know, you start talking about like, there's a chip of your life that's on the table. There's a chip of, you know, as far as the effects that it's gonna have on your family, your kids, all these consequences. And when he said, when you step back, it's not a fair bet. It's not a fair bet in regards to when you start engaging in that lifestyle and what you putting on the table. You know, so, and really looking at it like that. And I mean, most people that are, if they headed down the wrong path, as far as getting swallowed up in the streets, I guarantee you that none of them can kind of look around and see any really success stories. It's like, okay, all the older guys is probably like dead in the penitentiary. They buddies is, you know, getting shot at and doing some shooting and getting shot and going to jail. It's just like, it's a fool's game, basically. That's how I look at it.
So you still kind of live in the area that your crime, that you committed your crime at. Would you ever be interested in talking to like the youth or anything? Or do you do any of that?
Because, and this is where kind of, this is one of my struggles. Because mind you, for 12 years of me being locked up, I'm working in the education department. So I was a Ball State, a Ball State college clerk. I'm a GED tutor. I was in all these kind of roles. Like, people that was locked up with me, it's like, you know, the guy that works in the education department, a lot of people know me as that guy. So with that being said, a lot of my time locked up, I was doing that. You know, like, I'm kind of like, especially when I started hitting, like, the lower level facilities, it's like, okay, I'm the GED tutor that's been locked up 15, 16, 17 years, and here it is, I'm in a classroom full of 20-year-olds that got 3 years. So, you know, as far as, like, playing that kind of mentorship, trying to get them to see life differently. But so when I come home, I'm willing to do those type of things, but mind you, I come home as kind of like, I want to filmmaking videography. So it's like, you know, that's kind of like my primary drive. And I can't say, just honestly speaking, it's like my same drive in regards to speaking isn't the same, but I think that I have a response. I think that everybody, not just me, I think that we have a responsibility to help guide younger people in a more productive fashion. That's just like, to me, that's, you know, just human. And I was actually doing it when I first came home. I was actually going to alternative schools and stuff like that. But then kind of, you know, life kind of happened, getting jobs and stuff like that, and then trying to do what I'm trying to do. So it's kind of, I do less of it now, but I do plan on doing more of it. And kind of ironically, matter of fact, I just really thought about this, because it is happening. Because I get so many messages on social media about, from kids and stuff like that, who like, hey, big bro, appreciate it. You kind of, you teaching me something every day. It's just, when I was just giving that stuff, I was thinking like, oh, being around directly. So I think it is happening in a social media kind of world, because, you know, I get like a lot of that. I get a lot of that. So
I was going to say, you probably, I mean, if you have a huge TikTok following, you make these videos, you're definitely reaching people. And also, I'm going to kick myself if I don't ask this question. Can you tell us about your TikTok name? Because you said there was a story there. So I want to hear that.
Okay, so, and I never did a video about this. I get questions about it all the time. Okay, so, here's behind my comrade SinQ. Now, first off, this was a name I came up. I didn't come up with it when I was, I came up with this when I was locked up. So, comrade. I was thinking about when people hear the word comrade, what does it kind of draw up? People think a more leftist, socialist type of political line. You know, you kind of Bolshevik Revolution, Vladimir Lenin, 1917, comrade, you kind of associated with that. Not the Soviet Union or what Joseph Stalin was doing. That's different. He's a bad guy. So it was like that element of somewhat giving a person an idea of where politically I may be coming down the pike. And then also as far as just the concept of it being, you know, comrade, brother, you know, somebody that kind of shares the same type of beliefs and y'all kind of riding out on the same cause together. So that was that part. Kind of like, hey, you hear comrade, and it's like, hey, you know, okay, we may be talking about somebody that's leaning far to the left when it comes to their politics. And then the Sin Q. Okay, so there was a guy, his name was Prince SinQ. He was one of the princes on the Amistad ship. Now, the Amistad ship, if you don't know, it was a slave ship that the slaves actually revolted, took control of the ship, but they didn't know where the hell they was going and still landed in America. But because they were illegally taken from Africa, they went to court. And they actually won and went back home. Now, the prince that led the revolution on that ship was Prince SinQ. Boom. Then you fast forward up to the 70s, and there is this SLA, the Sudanese Liberation Army, which was this revolutionary arm, you know, back in the 70s, you know, during that time in America that was like really trying to, you know, get some change in this country. And the person that was ahead of that group name was SinQ. And he took his from the prince. But I adopted those two and I dropped the C and I put an S because I just want to have a, you know, a little bit more edge to it. And I can get a little bit more edgy when it comes to certain things. When it comes to film. So it's like it works, you know.
I like it.
Do you have any other questions that you'd like to ask?
I think that I got all of my questions in. Thank you so much for being here. Ariel, do you have any?
So how can people find you on TikTok?
I'm Comrade SinQ. Yeah.
On everything? TikTok, yep. Instagram?
Yep. TikTok, Instagram. Great, start my YouTube channel.
Oh, you're going to start one?
Yeah, I am. I have to. Because, see, one thing is like, you know, it's a longer format. You could talk about things in a less restrained, longer fashion on the other format. So, you know, I'm actually going to be working on that this week. But it's, yeah, Comrade SinQ. And I do have to say this. Because when I got the email, and mind you, I get a lot of these. But when I read the email and then I went to y'all podcast and I seen what was kind of going on, and I'm like, I want to be a part of that. Like, because it's like, not only are y'all doing just great work in regards to, like, you know, the message that y'all putting out, but there's a brilliance and an extreme creativity in the way that y'all are going about it in regards to like using the letters and reaching out to people that are in those situations and then using their words as a catalyst to, you know, get a conversation going. It's like, I really appreciate what y'all doing. And yeah, that's why I showed up. That's why I'm like, I can definitely get down with this. This is good shit, basically.
Thank you.
I know. I'm glad you think that.
Yeah. You're brilliant. Thank you for being on here.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for listening to our episode. Again, that was Michael Lacey, but you can find him on TikTok, Instagram, and hopefully soon YouTube as Comrade Simcue. And if you have any questions for him and you're listening to this, we will send them over to him and see if we can get him to answer anything else. But yeah, we will see you again next week for our next episode, episode 10. So thank you for listening.